Great. So yeah, go ahead and project whichever one is going first.
Do I use my computer audio or use the audio of the?
Use the audio in the room.
Okay.
Are you guys able to hear us? I don't know if anybody can hear.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, great.
That's someone in.
Oh, they weren't on the list.
Okay.
What are you saying?
Karina's not here yet.
She's online on her
She's
iPhone.
online. She's
Yeah, I
on
see.
Instagram.
Kalyana, are you on your way in, or are you gonna watch from remote?
I'm on my way in.
Okay.
All right. Okay, today I'm giving an update on ENDIF. We've got a lot of cool, exciting changes in year two. Specifically in this presentation, I want to talk about the different use cases of NDIF and like hopefully get some feedback from you guys on like what would be useful for you in your experiments and maybe like categorize certain types of experiments. And then I'll talk about the new features that are coming and like how we're addressing these different use cases. So to be useful to you guys, NDIF can do a few things. Obviously we can make insight better. We can make the API better. We can make it more expressive so it can do more things, which we're already doing, of course. We can have more learning resources. So we can have tutorials, workshops, lots of implementations for different papers using NDIF and Insight. And then, of course, we can just broaden the applicability of ENDIF and, satisfy a lot more people's use cases. So, people who maybe weren't using it before for some reason, now they actually have a reason to use NDIF. And a lot of those changes come with actually changing, the server side NDIF code. And so that's what I want to talk about today is how to broaden the applicability of NDIF to researcher use cases. So I was trying to think of some different ways to like categorize the different use cases for ENDIF. I have three, but I'll only talk about two of the slides. One is categorizing small experiments categorized by like they're fast, they're exploratory. There's usually not super critical, but you're just trying to like try something for the first time or do like an exploratory analysis on a new technique or a model you haven't done before. Iterating on your experiments, and to make all that actually possible, it needs to be fast. You need to be able to, if you want to try running LogitLens on a new model that you haven't seen before, or like your small experiment, you don't want to have to be waiting a while. Like, I don't know, at least personally, I would just be like, well, forget this. Like, I'm not even gonna bother with it. If just to try this little tiny thing, which I'm not even sure about in the first place, I'd have to wait a long time. And usually in these type of experiments, you're targeting like a small pool of models. Like you're saying, my entire study is going to be on Llama 8 or 70B, or maybe just all the Llama models, but it's not going to like span across all language models in general, like Gemma and GPTK and such. So short waiting times definitely important. Having a large pool of models so you can do your little experiments on say like any model. Because this doesn't prevent you from doing these little experiments on, say, some random model that I've never heard of. People send me samples of code. I see like this weird string from Hugging Face. I'm like, what is this model? But I'm sure you all guys have these use cases all the time. A big thing for this use case and the other use cases, but I'm highlighting in here because of just how important it is for everything is reproducibility, right? So like, you want to make sure that your experiments on the model that you think you're running on is the same every time. And really, that's just a matter of making sure at least the same seed is locked in for your experiment, the same configuration, and something that we don't really do right now, but we're gonna have for another important thing in year two is like the same revision. So, in like Hugging Face, you can specify revisions for like the different training checkpoints of the model. Not as important is you don't necessarily have to have like super short waiting time for like uncommon models. I think there's an understanding of if you want some weird model, as long as we can serve it for you at some point, I think that's probably good enough for that particular use case. Oh, I didn't finish this, but there definitely should be an understanding of like the behavior of like, okay, fine, you're not going to have this weird model for me, but I want to know like when will I be able to run it? So then I can actually like schedule and plan for the future that I can actually eventually. So on the other hand, are just large experiments, which I the characteristics are they're systematic. You're probably running some script that does some large sweeping experiment over many models or large models. It's time consuming. You'd probably be fine running this for like a day, a couple days. And usually these are more critical, where you're like, okay, I have an experiment, or I have some technique that I've iterated on and I'm kind of happy with. Now I want to actually run it on a huge data set or a bunch of models, and I want to build my table for my paper, right? So, doing grid search over parameters, benchmarking over tons of models for your technique, studying training dynamics, so, going over multiple different checkpoints. And then just even if you might not use a lot of models for these large experiments, you might have really long jobs, again, iterating over a data set, doing some kind of optimization loop, or, large models like 405B and, even bigger ones. Those will still be long jobs, even if it's probably a smaller type of experiment. So again, reproducibility in a large pool of models are important here as well. Having fast data integration. So one problem with these type of use cases is for data set iteration, you kind of have to upload the data set as you're running it to NDIS. But we definitely need at some point some way to cache common data sets, or you to upload things to an S3 bucket that you can connect to. Because you guys do this a lot, and it certainly is not tractable right now for iterating over large data sets. Having job status and feedback. So, if you say, like, okay, well, here's my job that's going to build my main table for my paper that I want to kick off. I don't want to just kind of like it just throw it into the cloud and then hopefully it works. I have no idea. So you should be able to get, feedback either in your console for sure, and then ideally check on it, be it email, some type of notification, like when things are done, did it break, what happened. And then APIs for, automating this process. So like if you want to build like some type of framework on top of this and rely on it for the future, you want to have all the tools for you to actually be able to build those automation tools. And then, one of those things is job cancellation. So like if you want to run a long job and you're like, oh, well, I actually forgot one line of code. Now that's going to take 2 days. Well, you should definitely be able to cancel your job. For these type of jobs, having like immediate access to any model in the world isn't as important as like the smaller experiments. Again, you want a large pool of models, but you don't have to say like if I tell you, okay, you can run your 3 day long job, but it's going to happen on Monday, and today's like Friday. That should be okay. And so before I go on to like how we're addressing these, maybe just like a little open discussion on the general categorization architecture of like these different use cases that I've laid out. Specifically, I'm looking for use cases that have to do with these type of like sweeping over many different types of models, iterating over data sets, which I don't think Nikhil's here, but for his paper, he had to iterate over a huge data set, and that was a huge problem because even if it worked 99% of the time, well, if I have one of the rows break, well, he has to have all this code that retries and resumes from a specific point of his experiment run. Any questions on that?
So I think so I actually wrote that piece of logic here. So what was happening is that sometimes when the model when NDIF side actually sends us the data sometimes get corrupted somehow. I don't know how that happens,
Probably during
but
unpickling, it'll give you like an error or something.
yeah, that is I actually forgot what kind of error, but it's a decoding error, some kind of a decoding error. So the data got corrupted. But it happens so rarely, like every 100 requests, it will happen once. And that's why we need to have this try cache thing. But then it got solved. I thought that it's resolved now, right?
Like as of like a
Because
month or two ago,
because I remember that you
DWS.
specifically said me to remove that piece of logic, and I removed it, and then we ran everything again, and it was fine.
Maybe it's because we were using we had a single VM and we were using like MinIO as our object store before, and now we're using an AWS bucket.
That actually might be it, yeah. And that's also how you're doing 405B, or like was this happening
We
to you on
were
70B or anything, but you weren't using.
So I believe that we were doing it for 405B.
So that was the only like our distributed model, and like that had so many different problems because it was distributed. So like I would imagine it had something to do with that, but
Probably.
that's why, it's not distributed anymore. So maybe that's why. I don't know.
Probably, but I am assuming that that problem is now resolved. Also, I was waiting for you to finish, and I wanted to say that sometimes the jobs get queued, and the users definitely should have an option to cancel their jobs, but you are already addressing that. So,
Working on that right now.
yeah, so awesome.
Yes. Oops. Any thoughts or session points? The access to buckets is also awesome. Yeah. Don't know, Chris, do you have any other thoughts? Like, that's probably
Internal. Yeah, are you talking about having buckets that you can put data in yourself?
Yeah, like if you just want to specify their own S3 bucket, be able to connect that to your experiment and pull it from there versus like, your crappy laptop
Oh, I
bucket.
see. Okay. Chris, do you want to explain verbally?
I don't think there is much to explain. Just it's I imagine it being useful to, be able to download data from my bucket.
Yeah, I guess too, because you could use forget the jargon they use, but there's different like protocols for fetching data from AWS, or sorry, from S3 that could be like really fast. And if or Insight allows you to use those interfaces, it might mean that you can make your experiment actually a lot faster if you're able to like batch grab data using the AWS or the S3 protocols versus just like having it serially uploaded from Insight directly.
Yeah, so sorry, go ahead, Chris. So I'm just trying to get to, I'm gonna show you a really cool demo of like a lot of the stuff is pretty much done, and I'm really excited to show you guys. But like so what does a lot of it do? So to have more models, where we can't host every model in existence at the same time, but of course we can on demand swap in your model when you've requested it. So that's probably gonna be like the biggest offering and piece of NDIF, and there's a ton of stuff around that in order to make that like work and make that nice. But it's when you request any Hugging Face Transformers model, it should be able to be deployed. Your request ran, and then if somebody else comes along, at an appropriate time, remove yours and put it back up. We want shorter waiting times for this on-demand model allocation. So we want to essentially have tiers of how readily available model is. So at its most available, right, it's already on GPU, it's ready to serve. Below that, we'll have a CPU caching mechanism where if you've already requested a model and it's come down, we actually don't totally take it down. We just move it to CPU first. So then the next time you request it, it's actually up in half the time it would normally be if you loaded it from disk. And then finally, we have a bunch of models already downloaded. Those are, cold storage, and we can, host it for you as requested, just like with warm. But it'll be slower, obviously, because it's from disk. For reproducibility, we want deployments by revision. So one of the use cases that have been noted is like doing old mode checkpoints or something, right? You want to iterate over a ton of different checkpoints for the same model to understand how it changes over its training. But right now, when you request a NDIF model, all really that we're looking for is just the repo ID. So you can't really specify a specific revision. And I have some questions about exactly how that should work in the sense like if you don't specify a revision, should it just kind of like use whatever revision is up, or should you always have to specify a revision no matter what? I don't know if you like or don't have like a thought about that. Like I imagine a lot of the time when you're like loading a Hugging Face model, you don't specify like revision equals the checksum or data.
Usually not. Usually it defaults to main. But if you want to iterate over like different checkpoints, then you should be able to do that.
But then like let's say like you request to run a job on like Olmo or whatever, and you don't specify the revision, but the current deployed revision is like the second to last one. Do you care? Like, is it like, oh no, I really need the most recent revision?
Usually I don't care.
No, but I think
I
that
think they do care.
I think they do care. I think that you should, I think reproducibility is important. It should just give, like, it should go to main. Right. Yeah.
It always defaults to main though, right?
It
Right,
should.
but
It
like if
should be that.
somebody else before you said like I want the second to last revision, and then we deployed that, and let's say it's like 405B, and you know it's going to take a while to redeploy like the latest
Okay.
revision.
I think you want main.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think you want to have a situation where, I ran a 4-hour experiment, and then tomorrow I run it again and it's different because, it's a different checkpoint.
Is it possible that the main ones are always deployed, but like you just upload the revisions?
Your cache.
No, I mean like we can't like we don't have enough resources to deploy the main of like all the main models and then have space for people to do revisions.
Yeah, I think like if someone just doesn't specify a revision, it's just it should be the main.
I mean, one option could be you have main is like always like hosted or not always hosted, but like if a user wants a revision. It will bring up the revision, the experiment will run, and then it'll swap back for main afterwards.
Yeah, that could make sense.
So we want a lot more transparency into the system because it is going to be, significantly more complex. So users should have an understanding of how long it's going to take to deploy. Ideally, it would even ask you to say like, okay, it's going to take an hour to deploy. Like, do you still want to do it? As of now, it'll just, tell you a time and we'll do it for you, but. Finally, you'll have a position in the queue, which is something we should have had a long time ago, but like because of one of the dependencies we have, it's just really hard. And then for some models that are, maybe like up all the time, you want to like be able to see the schedule and say like, oh, I know 405B is going to up be up in this week, and then 405B instruct is going to be up the next week. I can plan for my experiments that day. So demo wise. So I have GPT-2 up and deployed right now. So I'm going to run, generate on it, get some 10 new tokens, and then return those back to me. Nice. Cool. Okay, so, but now I'm going to ask for Llama 8B instead. And what this will do is this will go to the server, say, hey, please give me Llama 8B. It won't be up. So the system will have to take down GPT-2, kind of just like a 1 GPU machine, and then deploy 8B. So then it's saying, hey, okay, here we're deploying it for you. Please stand by. We're dispatching your request to the newly deployed model. And then within like 6 seconds, it should deploy and execute. Cool. Nice. That was pretty fast for Llama 8B. So what this actually looks like from your perspective is our brand new status page. Whoa, look how pretty it is. So we're going to get the model status, which is going to show you these different tiers. And right, so we just requested Llama 8B. So now it's running, it's hot, it's ready to serve. And we just brought down GPT-2, but like I said before, bringing it down doesn't immediately, destroy the entire deployment. It just moves it to CPU. So now you know that like if you now request GPT-2, it's going to be up pretty fast, and be ready to serve. And then here are all the different models I have in my Hugging Face cache on cold storage. So for some models, right, really like large ones and ones for specific offerings, say like our 405B pilot program, we're going to want some models deployed all the time. So 100% these will be up. We've guaranteed it for you. And before, that would be a very manual process where we went in, changed the config, redeployed everything. How we're doing it now is we have this Google Calendar, which you as a user could, attach to your own calendar. I'm going to say tomorrow, I want 70B to be deployed. And then the day after that, I want Llama 8B to deploy. And the status page will reflect that. So 8B is already deployed. But I guess it'll start again in on Monday. But yeah, 70B will start on 8 p.m. For 24 hours and be available. I also got these nice little like copy buttons on the top right of these where like it'll give you a little snippet of inside code that allows you to run this model. And so, if you didn't know how to do it, I can do it.
So right now you are not imposing any restrictions on any kind of models. Like you are not whitelisting any models, and also like not restricting any like imposing any restrictions on users. Like I can just run 10 experiments, request 10 405p models, and I should be able to just do that.
So here are the, I guess, restrictions. One, of course, with Hugging Face, you have the trust remote code flag. That's obviously false here. So like you couldn't just upload your own model, write anything in the model architecture and then us run it. It has to be one of like the Transformers models, like Gemma, GPT, Llama. So, and that's a pretty big pool of models, the main models. But you couldn't execute any code you want via models.
Let's say I have this access to all of these models.
Like you have, what do you mean? Like you have gated access or something?
So I'm assuming that for Llama you need to like fill up some sort of consent form, imply that, and then they give you access to that model. Let's say I have that access. And
And
then
we don't,
that
you're saying?
happens. No, you also have that.
Okay, yeah.
But let's say I want to I'm just trying to understand like how generous you guys are actually, or that how generous NDIF is. Let's say I want to just to mess with you. Let's say I have like I am trying to run experiments on like 10 4 billion parameter models, and I have access to those models. Let's say those models do not even require any kind of access. Can I just load them on
Yeah,
NDIF?
absolutely. You can make a
Okay.
loop right now. Do what I just did in a loop with different models. It would bring one down, bring one up, bring one down, bring one up.
Okay. Are you sure that you guys want that?
So some restrictions will be again. So a lot of this stuff is like stuff we just have to like tune. I don't really know.
You're not just gonna say yes, we can do it.
We have a minimal deployment
Well,
time.
if not, we should probably have a wait list. Well, no, I mean, like, I was gonna say yes, you could deploy any model, but obviously there will be some restrictions about like how fast you can change models. Like a model should be up for some minimum amount of time before being able to be evicted, which is functionality here. But in the sense of if you're willing to wait the minimum amount of time, yes, you could loop over like a million models and do whatever you want.
And then, so do you tell, how do the user know that that's the deal?
That it's only up for this amount of
So
time.
they say, hey, you know what? I have this great idea now that we have NDIF. I'm gonna write a paper where we study, 500 different models, right? And then they start and they can study, three models, but then they get honeypotted. It gets slower and slower because you have some hidden, scheduling thing. Is it just hidden that, they can't actually do 500 because it would, we have some policy that, makes it really slow to do that, or is there some way that they
Right
would?
now, it's not like slowing it down based on like some user request. It's just saying there's a minimum amount of time for a model to be up. And that is reflected both on the status page and then.
So it does it say? So it doesn't say on the
Yeah,
status
so
pages, right?
I don't have a time configured right now on mine. I just have like this way because I want to like show bringing models up and down.
I see.
But yes, if I configured it to be like an hour, it would show like an hour left. It's pinned for this long.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. So if somebody, if the cluster is sort of quiet, nobody's using it. And then somebody starts their project where they're going to study 500 models, and then they load the first 20, and then now they're all pinned for an hour. Does that mean that nobody else can use the cluster for their regular models now?
Yeah. There probably should be some type of rate limiting for deployments as well as just normal
I
requests, which
see.
we have.
Yeah. So I that's yeah. That's I, so I'm like I worry that the graduate students will be very creative in the types of research that they want to do,
I mean, that excites
and
us to break it.
I know, but I worry that if we kind of come out and we say, hey, you can do anything, and actually you can't. Yeah, that's why. I'm a broken record. I think on release day we should have a wait list with like one model in it. Like, you know what I mean? And then gradually bring it up because it's not just.
is the system capable of doing something? There's an interaction with, what the clever researchers are going to push the system to do. And we have a unique chance to shape that traffic with a whitelist. If we don't have a whitelist, then we don't have any control over what that traffic is. And now we can add a whitelist later, but then we'll make everybody unhappy because people will be like, well, I already, started my NURBS submission with these things and it's not on the waitlist. And you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's
Yeah.
a good idea. Kind of listening.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I think that
separately.
we should I think we need to
I
do
think
that.
that the end game that fixes all this is like, again, like a credit system.
Well, right. Yeah. But yes. But it's gonna take some time, right?
Yeah, a question about that. So let's say I deploy a model, right? It was not already deployed, so it has to be uplisted for an hour. That's the rate you've set. And then somebody else, and all the resources are taken, and somebody else asks to deploy another model. Will the request fail because the other
Yes.
model is still deployed for like an hour? Is it just like
Yeah.
canceled, or is it in the queue
It
until the other
fails.
one
It fails.
goes down?
So I was thinking
Yeah,
right
and
now.
that's, there's no available space.
There's
Like,
no available.
And the same thing happens if it's gated and we hadn't on our end, like had our unbased token get approved for it. They'll just throw an error back to the user. I don't think it says specifically, well, yeah, I don't think it says specifically the model is gated, but I think in the I think there's a particular return status from the controller that says this model actually doesn't fit. Like it's not just that there's not space to place it. It's just it won't work on the cluster. And then it says in the description, like maybe it's gated, maybe it's too large. And in the case of gated, it would probably be more clear to the user. But yeah.
So then I just have to like keep watching the status page to see when there's like a model goes down for me to be able to like send a request in.
Yeah. I guess you could just make a script. Might be what people do in practice.
Oh, so the model like has to stay up for at least an hour. Is that how you set it up right now?
We almost certainly need to do like more interesting things than that, but that's like the most basic thing we've done so far.
Oh, like if I want to just run an experiment for a couple of checkpoints, but the experiment takes like 5 minutes. So what I want to do is I just want to upload the model, like first checkpoint, run my 5 minute experiment, then take it down and like load the next one. So it's not possible with this.
As it works right now, no.
I think maybe we can
Sorry.
have like in the request, when you request a model that's not up, maybe the person requesting can have a flag that like, oh, just take it down after this experiment.
Or just like a
Like I only
max
need it for
time
this
duration
request.
where there's a default and then you could suggest anything less than the default. So if you want it for only 30 minutes, then you put in 30 minutes. But you can't put 2 hours. You can only put max 1 hour. But if you really know it's going to be quick, then you can, yeah. Like,
So
yeah.
another thing I was a little bit confused about, let's say I ask for a specific revision of OMO. Are you like rewriting or swapping the main model with the revised model?
As far as we're concerned, they're just like different models altogether. Like it's just
Okay.
like,
Yeah.
yeah.
Like the main model might not even be up. Things,
Right.
what are you saying?
Yeah.
So let's say the main model is also up.
Yeah.
Let's say it is something just you just offer as default. It's already
Right.
running, and I ask for a specific revision of OMO. Now I have two different models. One is whatever the default one, and another one is whatever I if I ask for a specific revision, it will give me that.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
There's really no like time savings to be had to like, even if we like wanted to like swap out like the parameters just for revision, yeah.
You don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I have a question. Can once the model's up, if other users start using it, is there something where it's like, okay, multiple users are using it, let's keep it up? Are you considering that?
I mean, yeah, again, like all of these things I have like on a list like to consider,
Cool.
and then we can like tune it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really, at least personally, I feel like I need to just see how people use the system and see how it behaves to actually know which one of these to use and how to set the values. But yeah, like that is definitely something we should consider. Like, are there things in the queue? How many people are using it in the queue? When the last time it was used? So on and so
Right
forth.
now, just we'll inform all the users that the model was evicted and just failed their request. But in theory, that could be changed to then try and submit the models be scheduled again before actually failing them if it doesn't actually get scheduled.
I'm going to anticipate a question. I see Sumit's hand is raised, but I'm here in person, so I'm going to ask his question first, which is, so you're going to learn from the user behavior. So how do you know what the user behavior is that you're going to learn from?
Talk with them.
That's one way. Or
do we, like, do you need, like, really specific logs or things like that?
Logs to see how long people are waiting.
And do we need, like, analysis tools to extract the relevant stuff from the logs so that you can use it to decide on?
Yeah, I mean, nothing that complicated. Well, I guess maybe there is some, like, algorithm we could find, like, given, you know, users are waiting this often and, you know, users' requests fail this often because they're not having employment. What is the optimal best values? I guess that's probably possible for some things, or at least some heuristic to get better. But yeah, waiting times and queues, how often people's jobs don't get ran because it was too full.
Do you think that we're logging everything so that any of these questions could be asked?
Well, the queue has a state which any moment in time can be fetched. And the state contains like a snapshot of everything in that point in time. And in theory, there could be a tooling built on top. Like, and you can get access to the state via the queue's endpoint.
So
like,
is it ephemeral or is that logged?
It's ephemeral, but it could be.
We already know from logs how long people are waiting in the queue, like if their job failed because it was full.
But I don't imagine that the state is very large. It feels like it's the kind of thing that you could just log exhaustively so that you can analyze like how the queue is behaving.
That's what I had in mind. Yeah. At least some capacity of, I imagine that being sort of a source of truth that would be used by testers, would be fetched by, for example, the status page to get information and insight of what's going on in real time.
Yeah. And like if you guys are hoping to learn from behavior
and debug analysis, if things are going wrong, you have this dump of them for the last whatever week, and you can just
why a week? Why not just as you deployed it?
Yeah,
right. I don't know, unless we're talking about terabytes of data,
it may grow quickly. I mean, it depends how much of it you store. Terabytes. Each tick has a different state. So, it's pretty.
I don't know. I've been logging something for 15 years, pretty exhaustively, like every click or something. Mm. And we're only 100 gigabytes after 15 years. I think that probably can log a lot more than you think.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah. So Sumit, you had a question.
Yeah. It's related to democratizing access, right? So is it weekly or monthly? How do you keep tabs on? Say I have no greater than 100 billion parameter model, and then cumulatively over a week, I can't run more than say 400B or use more than certain GPUs. Are we keeping tabs on a user? How do we keep a track of this in terms of just utilizing GPUs and a model size just being small and medium and doesn't go large? Or are they allowed to do large and they can do multiple large models?
So or is your meta question like, how do we make it fair so that one user doesn't using the system as their own private cluster?
Yeah.
Right. That's why, like, it either has to come from just like general system behavior, like we're saying, where if a bunch of people are using one model, it shouldn't come down, and you know, one person's request shouldn't bring it down. Or it comes from, like you're saying, like tracking the user and actually putting like restrictions on. Okay, you can only have a hot swap happen twice a day or something. You know, I don't know how to tune. That's like a whole.
I think that's pretty
career in itself.
No, I think. Well, I think you can have a user can only do X number of model requests per day, or like they have a number of models they can request for, and it could be something like big. But
that might exclude certain types of important research, though. That's right. So, Mia, what was your?
I was gonna ask. Like, I totally get the idea of wanting to learn from whatever users do, right, and adjust to that. But do you maybe have like a preset expectation of how you'd want them to go about it? Like, you can bake that into the system, sure, with credits or whatever, or you could just put up general guidelines in a blog post or some tutorials.
Tutorials for sure.
New users just kind of know how to behave, right? Like, for example, you're saying if everything's full, then my request isn't even going to the queue, right? It's just getting rejected. So does that mean I should be pinging the server like every couple of minutes? until
Until it's
I,
free.
yeah, until it's free. And if so, that seems like a set script that maybe we can at least like provide, right? So people aren't coming up with their own, scripts that do this every second or something, right? Like, I think it makes sense to bake things into the system, but I'm wondering if there's just a way to set general guidelines and have good faith that people will follow them.
Yeah, again, like we even talked about something exactly we're talking about, like a retry script, or I can like build into how the remote backend works.
Yeah, and again, like it doesn't have to be like coded in as much as it's just,
Told and like a lot of resources, people are trying to say.
exactly. I mean, that would just be building it into the queue so that if in the queue the user a request is not able to get through, it still keeps, it just sits there and keeps trying to, it has the an attempt to have it be scheduled until it is scheduled. So you can know that you submit your job and it'll just sit there in the queue until there is a free spot for it to go in. That seems like sort of what you're asking for, because just giving them a few scripts to do it. I mean, my thought on a lot of this, kind of on a meta point, from someone using the Slurm, the Delta Slurm, and having to do that for like just deploying, like learning how to deploy the system and having to deal with that, is I think there's like a process of like when you use a thing and you start to hit some roadblocks where you kind of figure it out yourself. Like I had to figure out weird, not that weird stuff, but with Slurm, just like, oh, if I just submit a job and it sits there, like I can just leave it and it will at some point go back up. But then, oh, if I forget about it and I need to look on it, like there's like a sort of user side to it, which I think you kind of figure out how to make it work. I don't know if that sounds very exclusive, exclusionary or anything, but that was sort of my experience using Slurm. So I'm not sure. It may translate to this setting where people will quickly realize, oh, this thing is hot and a lot of people are using this, and if I want to make sure my thing works, I need to do this, and they try that, and then, yeah, I don't know.
And don't you think you want the experience to be better than your experience with Slurm?
I mean, that's true. That's true, but I think, yeah, I mean, you can't know until you have that experience using Slurm. I think in this case, you kind of have to see first what happens, and then you can say, okay, there's these annoying things that could be smoothed out a bit, and
Yeah, I think that's the opposite of what the people are saying here, at least what I get is you start with a gated experience and it only gets better over time, rather than the opposite, that they are allowed this white field stuff of doing everything. And then this guideline becomes like in a document, which is like 5, 10, 15 pages. Every time a researcher needs to run an experiment, there are these guidelines that are changing over time.
how to deal with, like, we make a big system that doesn't work very well, and then expect people to develop a lore of like how to deal with this really bad system rather than dealing with a system that, maybe doesn't do much but works really well.
I guess like the way I'm thinking about it too is like you know what it's capable of, but nobody else like does right now. I like people using NDIF still think that there's only five models up. Like, so you don't have to tell them this is all we can do. Like, look at all these things we can do right now. You can just start telling them, all right, between these five new models, you can pick a new one to hot load, right? And like slowly scale it up as kind of new features in a sense that will get community engagement. Without having to kind of like test everything all at once.
If you also have the bonus that every time you offer a new set of models, it's like you can make another announcement and right, and say, oh, if you've been waiting for the latest multimodal models, we have three of them available for you, no video yet, check back next month, right?
So is that how you think we should roll this out?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, with that in mind, I'd be happy to kind of help by whatever guidelines or like have discussions about that.
Yeah.
Or like basically when you do this announcement, you can immediately attach in some tutorials and some guidelines of like, okay, request one model each time, right? Or something
A
like
thousand
that.
percent, yeah.
Even if the system can support more, right? Something to tell users so that they know how to operate within the system.
Agreed. Okay, that's all I had.
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
It's going to be huge. It's going to completely change the complexion of the service. You know, to
Agreed.
access more models.
If
And
you
yeah.
guys start building a whitelist, do you know what strategy you would do to like choose the models first? Like, am I
Well,
allowed
first
to
of all, I
provide
have to talk to
something?
our collaborators in our lab and ask
Ah,
them.
no,
So
okay. No,
my
we have a list.
lobby.
So Emma has a nice list. She's been pulling the existing end of users, and we have a list of models according to how many votes they've gotten from researchers. So we know, if you gave me one more model today, I know which one I would put on that would make the most researchers happy.
Though it has been pretty
Right.
hard to
Yes.
get community engagement. Just like putting up a poll on the end of Discord didn't get a lot of votes, right? So we would welcome suggestions.
Protein language models. Sorry. Talking to Michael about
Is
that.
there a specific one? Can you name it?
ESM too. I'll probably find one that's like most people would want. I think ESM is like
How big are they? How big?
I think they're pretty small. Yeah. I can load them on CPU like fast. But be really cool.
Wait,
I have a
yeah, and
back-end
so
related question. I don't
yes.
know if it's for this. So, how does the state of the world change once we have? So, right now we're using, say, four or six A40s and one H200. That's the shared infra from Delta, right? We have this reservation system. Essentially, we are planning to add another H200, which will be dedicated to us, which will be beefed up with all the CPU and RAM. Until we get to that point, do we anticipate any major issues for everything we've spoken, given it's shared infra and it doesn't have the CPU and the NVMe?
Well, so I mean, it does have some CPU. I mean, like, I feel like the hot swapping, warm stuff can't really, be as amazing as it could be unless we have the large CPU machines. But I mean, they have more CPU RAM than they have GPU RAM. So like,
Yeah, they have like a terabyte each, and then there's like each node has their own, so.
and then the NVMe, like we're not even considering right now, like doing the local NVMe as another tier of offering. It's all just from the shared drive on Delta.
And it's
So
pretty fast from the shared drive
yeah.
anyways. 4.5B takes 10 minutes to load. That's pretty quick. It's crazy. The
And how much does it take from RAM?
RAM, I
Yeah,
don't
if
know.
you were to swap it out and
Yeah, I
swap
haven't
everything.
checked. Yeah.
So, what was the last part?
David was asking how long it takes to swap from CPU for 400.
Do we know for 70B?
So I've been trying to run it on Saitama because that's the only two GPU machines I have available, and I can't run anything on Saitama right now. It's so slow. I can't run it on Beepu because it's too small.
Oh, I see. And we don't have a dev environment in Delta that
That's
big.
what Michael's been trying to
That's
do.
right. So we're still waiting in. Okay, cool. That's no problem. Just work today.
Oh, and so one last thing, I'm like, I don't know, are people like using Nagoya heavily right now? Or like, I was thinking maybe I could deploy a version of this
Yeah,
as
always.
one of Nagoya or Hakone. Yeah.
I sail our deadline,
Okay.
Kyoto is already also a two GPU machine, right?
Kyoto?
Yeah,
Okay.
I think.
Yeah, so there's two.
But
I also.
Oh, you're
Yeah,
using
no,
just one.
is there something physically wrong with the machine, you think? Do we have to like find it and unscrew it and clean out the
Using
fans or
two
something?
sites on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's slow for me this morning.
It's
It's
I the past 2 weeks I keep trying it, and it's like I'm trying to literally like.
Where's the time? Is that under my
I
desk?
think
I don't know where it is.
it's one of the machines there.
Should
So
we just reboot the thing and
I think
yeah, I mean we try that. Yeah.
I think actually Saitama might need a full clean setup because it has been slow for a while.
I see. Do you think somebody's mining Bitcoin
You
should
I
try it.
actually
I'll try
could
that.
not really find anything. So it's just slow in general. I don't know why.
Yeah, maybe just wipe the machine.
Yeah, we need to do that.
I mean, like maybe not Nagoya or something, but I would like to put up like a demo version of this for maybe some people to access and give their feedback.
What would be a good motivation to use this system?
And if
if I had to put like a version of this on like a
Baby end it.
on like say Hakone with like eight GPUs, I mean you could like hot swap
Yeah.
any model out.
And like five protein language models.
that was a big incentive. I'll be your test breaker, you know.
Okay.
I'll
Really?
Yeah.
You
Or,
would really use it?
well, I would definitely use it, yeah.
yeah, Alex isn't here, but like I was, you know, somebody who like does a sweep over multiple models.
You can ask Alex when. Yeah.
I don't know if anybody has like deadlines or trying to like run their experiment on a bunch of different models for a table and a benchmark or something. That would be perfect. But
I'm running them, but I'm training. I'm not sure if it's.
are you
It's his own
training?
models. Yeah. So what's the vision for when a researcher has their own models? Is there a vision for this?
They get their own hat. Their
Not
own.
really. I mean, like, yeah. I mean, I guess in theory, it's like not even that much different. Like, it's just we don't host a model, but you're running the same code, and your code can include like an entire model architecture and training. You would just have to, I guess, tell us how much GPU you'd want.
Oh, so what if it was a standard architecture, but your own checkpoint?
And so,
Like,
are you fine-tuning the whole model, or are you like from scratch?
pre-chaining the model.
From scratch, like.
But it's a standard, what, Llama or something?
Yeah, it's like it's.
Oh.
So I'm using the Hugging Face Pythia model. So like I can export it to a Hugging Face checkpoint actually.
Yeah, so I mean, technically, you could
Make
do
a
that
clone.
now. Is like you would just have to reinitialize all the weights in the model, which if you access the weights, it gives you a clone of them because you obviously you can't change the real ones. But I don't have a way to like swap in your weights for.
You can't if he puts on a thinking face, he can't just refer to that name.
Oh, yeah, but.
Which you could do, right? That's easy.
But like
Everybody
it
does.
would it a
But
bit
he couldn't
better.
optimize the parameters.
No. But let's say he optimized the parameters already.
Oh, okay. Then yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. But like, I don't know, is your experiment like about the training, or is it like you train it and then you can do stuff with it?
It both like
Okay.
I'm running some benchmarks over the checkpoints as well, like the ones that I've saved.
You could absolutely do that. You could upload them,
That's cool.
request
Would
them.
the whole weights have to get sent back after?
No, but he's saying upload them to Hugging Face, like, and then
From end of?
no, from
From my local layer.
wherever.
What I'm imagining is you do the fine tuning on end of, and then you want to save that checkpoint somewhere. And then
Yeah,
it gets sent
I'm
somewhere.
saying there's nothing technically stopping you other than the fact that you'd have to like swap in the weights every single time, like kind of recompute the model. But like, I have that's one of the things I want to add anyway. So.
But for Karem's actual experiment that he's actually running,
Yes.
he could use this. Now, once you put in the whitelist, he can't because
Yeah.
he's not going to be on the waitlist.
But
But
for our
like
demo
when,
version for the next month or whatever, yeah.
yeah.
So I'll try working with you guys and Alex and like meet with you. Hopefully we can find something interesting to do.
Also, have you like considered doing like two different policies, one for larger models, one for smaller models? Like for the smaller models,
Yeah.
you can just swap and swap back really fast, but like for the large models, you have a limit, kind of.
Okay, yeah. I mean, there's so many different things, but one of the
Yeah,
things,
like
yeah.
that could be helpful. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
It could be like one easy thing to do because, I
See,
mean,
with your models, like the smallest one is
yeah.
usually, right?
If I'm like, if I want to just float back and forth a 160 million model, like it should be like pretty. I should be able to like, if you allow me to do it pretty fast, it would be cool. But
Just curious, would using Pythia remotely make sense? I mean, I know you have access to GPUs, but it's a really slow
Yeah,
one.
not like.
Do you imagine it being useful based on the speed it would take to use it, to be able to swap a lot of them on Indiff versus like.
I mean, not for me, but I feel like a lot of people who don't have a lot of access to GPU, I feel like it would be helpful.
And for you, if you had all of them on Indiff and they were all cached in CPU, if you're using them once, it would be faster than using locally.
Oh yeah, true, because you have to load the, you don't have to download them. Yeah.
Yeah, problem.
Is there a way to visualize the current population mix in terms of the distribution for small versus large experiments? I'm guessing people move on from small to large eventually, but do you see that, or do we track that, and do we see that journey of the user by the user as they grow?
Yeah, we have that information. Like we, I mean, I imagine the proxy for how big the experiment is just the length of the experiment. Is that what you're saying? Like how much time
And
they,
it's
yeah.
length over a certain period of time. I'm guessing. We can bifurcate the existing user base easily. Is that how we measure and track?
We could do that.
David, do you think that would be a good data point?
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about it. I mean, I think that would be a good project for you to spearhead, to visualize the user behavior.
Okay. Yeah, and so like at the beginning of my slides, I talked about, kind of ways to make end up better, and one of them is all the learning resources, and that's what Amir has been working on. So he'll tell you about some of the resources we've been making for Inside Edif. So how about that? I just like join the Zoom. Yeah,
sounds good. Give me a second. How much time do I have, by the way? Just so I...
Negative 1 minute. So go ahead and take half an hour.
No, I'll take much less than that. While I'm loading this up, hello everyone. I'm Amir. I'm a summer fellow with the NDIF team, doing outreach. So I'm mostly writing and reorganizing the tutorials for Insight to help get user engagement and also help people who are kind of new to Insight or just the field of interpretability, know how to get started. So let me share.
So I'm here. What, tell us a little bit about your research background as well.
I did my undergraduate at Stanford, where I worked with Chris Potts, and I'll be starting my PhD there in the fall, working once again with Chris Potts. So I do causal analysis of language models, but just kind of generally excited about interpretability and how it intersects with linguistics. What kind of insights can we draw from some language models? Yeah, always happy to chat about research. And now we'll be chatting about tutorials. So I'm just going to quickly explain how I'm thinking about reorganizing the tutorials on for the Insight website. And then might not even go through the walkthrough, but just have like a call to action for this right-hand side applied examples that I'll talk about. So
But you should t take go ahead and take some time.
yeah.
It's okay. Yeah.
But I want to emphasize the call to action
Great.
because that's relevant to this code here. So right now, Insight has just a tutorial for different methods, based on what we thought users might enjoy doing, but there's no clear kind of structure around it at the moment, right? If you're a new user, you should already know what activation patching or DAS is, and then you're just looking to see how it's implemented in Insight. What I wanted to try to do is actually pretend like you're not necessarily familiar with these methods. Like you might know what language models are, what activations mean, but patching and causal analysis and logit lens might all be new to you because these are recent papers, right? And even if you kind of read the paper, Insight is very well designed such that you can actually learn from the implementation itself. So this left-hand side is kind of what I'm calling walkthrough tutorials or a curriculum of tutorials, where we'll take the main tutorials in Insight and reorganize them based on categories and subsections to kind of have a flow for new users coming in who want to learn about current interpretability methods. And that's cool and all if you're kind of trying to get started, right, or want to use Insight for something specific. Another complete different set of tutorials that I think would be very exciting would be ones that actually give you hands-on experience with recent findings in interpretability, right? Because these methods aren't just designed to be methods, they've usually discovered something exciting, right? So like, I don't know, linear representations of truth in models, for example, right? Or the fact that llamas seem to think in English even when they're translating from French to Chinese, right, or something like that. And so giving users the ability to actually quickly recreate these results, on just a 1 billion parameter model or something hosted on NDIF with one or like a handful of examples that they can quickly iterate on is a really cool way to play with actual results from recent papers. And I think it's also a cool way for researchers in the field to kind of advertise their work, right? And get people to think about what it is they've been discovering. So I'm actually going to start by talking about these applied examples that I'm going to call mini papers for like the rest of this. The vision here is I want researchers to be able to kind of take the recent paper and give the gist of their main results, right? Because you know, when you wrote the paper, you had to make it rigorous and scientific and emphasize, the key takeaways or whatever. But that might not have been what actually got you interested in the project, right? Or it might not even be the most interesting result that you got, right? And oftentimes, it's not even what you're thinking about at the moment. So oftentimes, the thing you're actually presenting in the paper and then the discussions you're having about it might be two completely different things. Tutorials are a great way to capture that latter part, right? What you're actually thinking about at the moment. What are the interesting takeaways from your paper? So the idea is to kind of add, I don't know, visualizations, animations, but mostly just interactive examples for you to share what you found during your research project. Here on the right, I just kind of included a few animation kind of exemplifying a discussion that David Bao had in the group chat about difference in means and why it works. If you go to the Geometry of Truth paper that introduces difference of means, there's this really nice figure four that tries to convey the same information, but due to space constraints, whatever, it's a single figure, it's kind of dense, it's pretty mathy, and it takes a while to parse. So this is exactly the kind of thing you can do with a tutorial. We can kind of explain what's going on. So what I'm showing here is, imagine we have kind of orange and blue dots in that paper. These corresponded to representations of true statements versus false statements, right? And you can see that they're easily clustered, which is kind of cool, right? That means that you might guess that the model is representing them linearly. And if you do that as a researcher, one of the things that might go to immediately is, okay, let's train a linear probe to actually cluster these things. And you might then run like a logistic regression probe. It'll find the line of best of like most separation, right? Which is that purple line you see on the left. And you get a clean separation. But what's interesting is that that direction of separation isn't necessarily meaningful. In fact, it's probably not going to cause the model to behave in the way that you want. What I'm showing here in the purple arrow is kind of if we were to take that linear probe and use this direction as an intervention in order to steer the model's weights, right? And you can see that what happens is that it doesn't perfectly match the distribution. There's a pretty fun story you can tell here about the fact that correlation just gets in the way. So this was a cool kind of example from David Mayer. So I'll go into it just a little bit. Imagine the story here is something like, you're a teacher, and this is your first year teaching this class. And you're keeping track of just kind of two things, the number of assignments that a student has turned in and their average grade on those assignments. And then the blue and orange actually correspond to whether or not they passed the final exam. So everyone in blue turned in a lot of assignments, had a pretty high average grade, and they passed. Everyone in orange didn't turn in a lot of assignments, had a pretty low average grade. But you can also see this correlation where if people who turned in more assignments had a higher average grade, right? Linear regression probes that just try to find the line of best separation pick up on that correlation. You can see that the purple line actually picks up on the fact that the average grade kind of goes up as the number of assignments turns in goes up. But if you were to then do an intervention based off of that, you're actually going the wrong way because while both number of assignments and average grade can tell the same story, you can see the average grade is actually just enough in this case to like completely separate the two clusters. And so if you were to use that as your proxy and to be like, wait, it correlates with this other thing that we want to ignore, you end up doing this weird adjustment where you say, okay, let's raise everybody's grades up and have them turn less assignments in, right? And that will help them all pass the class, which is maybe a little bit counterintuitive because you can tell that turning number of assignments actually correlates, or the higher grade and help students pass the class. So this is why having confounding correlations here actually causes a problem for this intervention. The story you might want to be able to tell is more actually, how do we make sure that these two groups of students end up lining up based on the metrics we've captured about them, right? So in this case, for example, difference of means will literally just take the mean student who passed the class and the mean student who failed the class and just looks at what's the difference between them. And here you can see that it would actually push in both directions. So you'd want students to turn in more assignments. You'd also want them to get a higher grade on these assignments. So it's kind of a fun story to tell. But my point here, like the point I'm trying to emphasize here is that this figure exists in the original paper, right? But the original paper couldn't tell this whole story with like a professor trying to improve their class or whatever because they had to submit to a conference, right? But with these tutorials, you can go into the examples that you care about more. You can give intuitions behind why some methods work and some methods don't. And it's a great way to kind of get people thinking about the same thing you're thinking about, which I think is like half of research, right? With that, I'll just kind of put a little blurb on the ones we have so far. So we kind of, we're probably releasing three of these soon. So function vectors is one that already existed on the inside website. We're just kind of repurposing it. The geometry of truth is the one I just talked about. Robert Sordis was really cool and wrote his own tutorial for how LLMs use their depth or really don't use their depth. We have a really cool one on memorization in language models and how you can tell which tokens in the input actually trigger memorization. And when you can tell that, you can do funny things where if certain tokens don't trigger memorization, you can completely mess up a sentence and it'll still be fine. So a lot of MMLU questions at this point are memorized, but their numbers might not be the thing that trigger memorization. If it's a math problem, it might be more the phrasing. So you can actually ask a model some question from MMLU, completely change the numbers in that question, and it will still give you the same response. That's one of those kind of neat findings that, again, didn't make it into the main section of the paper. If you go and read the appendix, it's there. And if you go and talk to the researcher, they'll have cool things to say about it. So this is kind of their chance to showcase it. We have one on lookbacks. And then this is my call to action. We want more and we want it from you all. So if you have a cool paper that does anything related to interpretability that you want to talk about, and better yet, you think you have like a fun, just minimal example for, talk to me, please. You know, we can work together. I can start drafting it and we can have a chat. If you already have something up, even better. But I think this is a really great chance to kind of connect between, you know, teaching interpretability to new people, while also getting your own work out there, right? And having people think about it. So keep that in mind. I'll pause here before continuing, because the next thing I wanted to talk about is actually like the main tutorials and how I'm thinking about reorganizing them. And that can be a really long discussion. So
I think when I was first listening, I misunderstood sort of the attention and I got really excited about something else, but it seems related because this is really actually in my mind super cool because it gets closer to research becoming something that gets like rigorously evaluated and has some sort of like version control aspect where you can standardize like, okay, here's in the standardized library format exactly what I did. And I can now control for things like, you know, different models. I can maybe control for like different data and you can kind of run more like larger value, like replicate, you can replicate results and see how much they generalize.
I think that would be a really cool vision. The way I was thinking about this originally is like something like a Kaggle dashboard, you know, which is, I think, kind of what you were saying.
Yeah, they're very related.
Right? This idea that not only can other people actually access and use it, they can build on top of it, rigorously test it, so on. But that might be asking a lot of a researcher who already has spent time kind of creating their own code base. So I'm trying to start like a little bit more minimally than that, just kind of say, let's recreate, you know, just that main figure from your paper And it doesn't have to be a perfect creation, right? It can just be like the gist of what's going on there. And that should be enough for researchers to be like, wait, okay, so if I just tweak this value, do I get a different result or something else, right? And then maybe they have a chance to follow up with you. Maybe they do something that spins on top of that. And we're heading towards that field of, mutual kind of testing and validation.
Do you have a vision for what would incentivize a researcher to create a mini paper? Like, if you were to try and sell it to them, like, so why should they make a mini paper? But they.
You all tell me. I give you my pitch.
I think it can be like a blog post for someone who I guess doesn't already have it, or they can just link it. Be like, okay, yeah, here's a tutorial.
Yeah, I'd also emphasize that this is more interactive than a blog post, which I think is kind of cool. Presumably, if you wrote a blog post about what you did, you needed to run some small code to recreate an example. If you share that code online, people can immediately play around with more than just that one example you put on a blog post site. Like,
also, a lot of people like frequently visit the InciteWeb website from a lot of different backgrounds, so you might get a lot more visibility on your research and your work than from your own blog post or in your own like website or lab's website maybe.
I'll be upfront here and say that I think the thing that will encourage researchers to do this the most is if people are already doing it. Like, if we have like 20 mini papers already up, and you go to the NSA website and you see that, and it's like, oh, they're getting traction. This could be something cool for me to do. It's more likely it kind of like, picks up. But we have to kind of get the ball rolling. 5's a pretty good number. If y'all can help me get to 10, that'd be amazing.
I think
Any other questions?
there's a couple other things that we could motivate you see because you asked. I think it's the standard right now if you want to release a piece of runnable code is you try to see if you can get it to run in Colab. Then people will just read a Colab thing. But then if your models that you want to demo on are just a little too big, then you can't do it on Colab anymore. And then people will just put something on GitHub and say, well, I guess you got to go find your own GPU and do it, right? But if you do it this way, then you can do it on larger models. But it may be the process of putting a demo up here should also allow you to get your like Kerem's models on the whitelist or something. It's like, oh, to demo my thing, you need to, have access to my three checkpoints and But if you're a mini paper contributor, maybe that puts your models on whitelists and then people can play with them. Right? Does that make sense?
Like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's something about so I agree that it's about the community. I think that if we can somehow normalize the idea that the best papers come with a runnable demo, and NDIF is devoted to providing everything that you need to have, at least your figure one be demoable. If that would I think that would be pretty.
Also, Chris asked about links to these current tutorials. I can start sending them out. But also, if you wait for an announcement coming hopefully Monday, we will just put them up on the official on-site website and just, start sending out the announcement for people to start looking at these links. That's something I was considering kind of actually going through in this presentation. If people are interested now, I can do it. I imagine that like another big blocker is just okay, what exactly do I mean by mini paper, right? And I'm like, kind of gave a vision of what I mean, but it's held without an example. So that's something that hopefully all of you can just like start looking at soon, because I'll have some examples up. And that's something I'm also just kind of happy to chat about if you hit me up or we find a time to do it. You know, once you have a template, right, it's a lot easier to kind of think about how to structure your own things with relation to it. Cool.
Send the links.
Chris, let's chat.
I'm have a different perspective, I think, a lot of other people in this room, because I'm kind of new to this world. And I actually use the tutorial page a lot, and I have been recently as well. But I was just saying, I think it'd also be cool because a lot of people that I know that aren't into this stuff as much, they like read a paper from Anthropic or OpenAI, and then they're like, "Oh, this is a really cool paper," but they can never recreate it, you know? So maybe looking at papers that get a lot of traction on Twitter or something like that, and then adapting them into a cool little tutorial like this on the EdInsight website, could be like a really great way to, I guess, add more mini papers.
Yeah, I really like that. I guess that's something I should have said as well. If you have an example of a paper that's not your own that you would want to see a walkthrough for, also come talk to me. I'd be very happy to do that. That was the geometry of truth is kind of like the closest one I have to like a paper that I think has gotten a lot of traction. Like difference in means stealing is kind of like gets talked about. But yeah, I think you're definitely right about the kind of topic of an AI papers.
Yeah, or you know, any number of research organizations.
Definitely.
You think like a good metric of like how satisfied your goal is would be if, for example, David could teach a class where every single lecture had a mini paper, a relevant mini paper for it?
Yes. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't be mad at that for sure. It'd be awesome. Yeah.
That's about 27 mini papers.
That
You took up 20 of the allotted 30. We can keep going with the walkthrough, or we
yeah,
can
you
just
can,
talk
yeah,
about it.
you can show a little bit of what the walkthrough.
Yeah, this is my first time at these lab meetings, so I don't know.
That's okay.
Well,
Yeah, but
what's the timing?
you're only here for a few weeks, so let's see the walkthrough a little
Cool,
bit.
cool.
Yeah, just
All
for a couple
right.
minutes. Yeah.
This is meant to be like a discussion, so I'm gonna put up like an overwhelmingly big slide, and then we'll just start talking about it, okay?
Can I add one small comment?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Sorry,
David,
I
no,
grabbed you.
no, David, in his deep learning class, you're like making us do some demos for some of the papers, right?
Right.
Maybe like some of the ones you like, right? You should upload them to the meeting paper.
Yeah.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, while we're still on this, the other vision here, it doesn't have to be a published paper, right? Like kind of with Kaggle dashboards, it might just be a student project you did too, right? I'm kind of calling these mini papers for now because I think it sounds cool, but I think the idea long term is really anybody who wants to contribute a tutorial showing something they've been thinking about. It's kind of a cool discussion forum almost, right? Where before this, you know, on the Discord, you'd have these like long threads and you're sending code blocks and you're linking your GitHub. Now you could just put this tutorial up on the EdInsight website and then link people to that, right? As a way to get a discussion going. So I think student projects would actually be a really cool way to do that because you'd have a collection of them and then you can just ask students, hey, are you cool if we put this up on the EdInsight website as an example of something you could do?
Sense.
So that might be something we can keep thinking about. Cool. All right. This is the overwhelmingly big slide to talk about. So now we're coming back to just, all right, this is what I talked to before is kind of like a list of mini papers that are not necessarily related in any way. Now let's talk about main insight tutorials and how to organize them. And I try to come up with a sort of categorization of how I think it might make sense to talk to somebody about interpretability if they're new to it. This is not an ordered list of things. It's not like you should start on the left and go to the right. I imagine each of these as kind of separate tracks, depending on what your purpose is. And roughly, they correspond to probing on the very left. So that is, given, you know, representations of the model, what interesting information can we decode from that? In the middle, it's steering. So what manipulations can I perform on the model to control its behavior in some way? And then causal mediation analysis, causal abstraction, something, something causal. You know, grounding what you're doing in theory to actually understand what these representations mean. And these are distinct things, and I'm happy to have like long conversations about these, but the things under them can definitely share categories, right? Like I'm not fully convinced of anything I've done here so far, and I have this like spreadsheet where I'm organizing these, and I move things around like every 5 minutes. So this is more of like a cool discussion with people who are at, you know, have all been thinking about interpretability for a while and are at cool different levels, right, in the field, and from like somebody who's pretty new to somebody who's deeply experienced in it. Could just be something fun to discuss, right? If you rolled back the clock and had to re-enter the field, how would you think about teaching yourself interpretability, right? I can just kind of keep talking a little bit more about examples within these, if that will be helpful. So for example, for predicting this idea of probing, you could train linear probes. You can do mean mass probing, which was that example I showed you. You could just not train a probe and use the model's decoder as your probe in order to read intermediate values. And that's kind of like the lenses, right? Like the logit lens. You can think of a logit lens as a linear probe that's just defaulted to the unembedding layer. That is what it does. It's just a multi-class probe where the class is the size of your vocabulary, right? And you're trying to decode what the next logit might be. In the middle, control, I'm mostly thinking about steering, but in my mind, I think steering is actually really related to the just idea of adapters on models, right? Like you have this steering vector that's an external thing and you're using that to change your model behavior. That steering vector can also be a learned representation, and now you have left, you're familiar with that. It can also be a learned weight decomposition, and now you have law, right? These are all ways in which you can just kind of have an external adaptation applied to the model in order to control its behavior. And then understanding is, I could talk about this one for a while, but causal analysis is really cool. There's lots there, right? Like you can talk about patching. You can talk about causal alignment. I kind of tried to break it up into these two columns because I think that's how a lot of people think about it. In a gist, it's like you can either look at what activations are important and then try to interpret them, or you can come up with your interpretation about what the model is doing and then find the representations that correspond to them. And roughly these kind of correspond to what I'm going to call causal mediation analysis and causal obstruction. I know it's kind of funny because I'm like throwing this at you after thinking about it for a while, and I'm like, what are your thoughts? But you can also just ignore this completely, you know, and throw in things that would be cool to learn about, right? Or cool to teach.
I really like the control section. That's like the way you categorize everything. But like, I guess going into this, I think that category right now is really applicable to me. What I want to do, and so if I was going to learn, I would just look at that column. Just like, this is a tutorial issue. Okay, so I think that's cool.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear. Yeah, this is definitely something I was thinking about. It was just like, you might have different purposes, right, in interpretability. Like, I think predicting is a super interesting thing you could just be doing without thinking about how it actually controls the model, right? And you could try to control without trying to understand.
Did you already make these? And are they going to be released on Monday too? Or is it just a new paper?
This is the grand vision. Some of these are already up. And on Monday, I will start color coding things.
For the causal stuff, is the goal to just like outline different broad areas of causal interventions that you can apply on models? Like, you could, you know, start like neuron and then like collection of neurons and like the whole output. And would the, like, I guess the question is, like, would you be kind of trying to find, like, what the researchers have converged on focusing? Maybe, like, single neuron stuff, you just, like, point to, in that tutorial, you point to a couple examples of, like, where a single neuron, like, does a big change if you causally ablate it and see what it does.
That's a great question. And, like, it's, yeah, I've been thinking about it for a while, and I finally converged to your way of which is crazy, yeah. So the way I'm thinking about doing it right now is kind of having a single underlying task, which is the REVL task, which is, imagine I have a sentence like, the city of Paris is in France. That sentence is kind of saying the city of Paris, which is like my entity, has lots of properties. The one I'm talking about is the fact that the country is France, right? And what you kind of learn with activation patching is you can actually intervene so that the city of Paris now goes to Italy, right? Even more interesting, though, is you'd want to be able to do things like the city of Paris, change the country to, like, say, Brazil, but keep it so that it's Europe. So we're only editing the country without editing, say, the continent or the language, right? And what I'm thinking is showing how different causal interventions kind of get you closer and closer to that. Because if you just do the residual stream, you'd be able to change the country, but you'd also be changing everything else. If you do attention heads, you might get close. Linear representations, you get even closer. That's the gist right now.
It's almost like a mini paper for the big survey paper that... the mediator.
Exactly. It's always hard to kind of like break these up between the applied and the curriculum section. So that's something I'm thinking about as well.
So what is the plan? Each of these mini papers will have one of these color codes, like predict, control, understand.
Mini papers can kind of pick and choose. Right? A lot of the time, they do a bit of both for mini paper.
They can have like tags.
Exactly. Like the way I'm thinking about it is each of these is like a mini lesson, and a mini paper is an applied example across things. Right? Like once you've picked up the right skill set, you should be able to do this. So
when you say something like a curriculum, I imagine like something like a syllabus, like there will be an index of things, and once you click on that index, it will expand, and then there will be like multiple tutorial series under that. Like, is that the plan?
Yeah, this is what I'm outlining here, but that plan is separate from the mini paper plan at the moment.
NDP is supposed to give research access, right? It's not only interpretability. So a lot of the times when I see like these control papers, I don't think of them as interpretability papers, because as long as something is connected to the computation graph, you will be able to mess with it to make the model say anything, as long as you are making a strong enough intervention, right? So maybe it should not be a curriculum for interpretability. Should be something like, or unless like this is something you are really strongly motivated by, like it probably should be like a, I don't know, curriculum for things can you do with NDIF? I mean, things can you do with model internals?
That's fair. I'm very willing to reframe this as curriculum for research with model internals, which is what I imagine Insight is trying to provide.
We can, I think that we can take ownership of the word interpretability and define it as we like. I think the idea that you want to control some, change some behavior, and that the best that you want to do when you're doing that activity is just change it at random, I think is probably not a very generous way of looking at what those researchers are trying to do. I think that, that if you're trying to control the system, you try to control it in some predictable way, and eventually they're learning to interpret, what they're doing. They're just using different tools and interpretability from another perspective, using a different set of abstractions. And so I do have, so a general question is, are there methods that you think are not represented here that you think a lot of people would want to learn about or read about?
So in my experience, people that have like the standard machine learning, deep learning training always have like a similar set of concerns when they talk to interpretability researchers, right? And one of these concerns is like, why would we bother studying like a single checkpoint? If we have no guarantees whatsoever that this thing generalizes to even a second checkpoint trained on the same data, just starting from random, a different random seed, right? That's the standard question that I get from people that haven't tried doing any of this kind of research. So I think that
So,
one should be addressed somehow, like in a conviction building section where you actually show that a lot of the results kind of transfer across different models.
that's interesting. So there's some like framing material that is beyond just methods that's sort of not represented here, which is interesting.
Yeah, I really like that. The closest thing we have to that right now is that the existing tutorials we have often go through a small model and then at the end give you the option to use NDIF to replicate this on a large model. And you can see that the results transfer. But that's never made explicit anywhere. So I really like the idea of like making that part of the introduction to Insight or to these tutorials as a whole.
So I'll name two random methods. One would be like salience methods.
Okay.
Do those live in any of these categories here?
If you're talking about attribution patching, then yes. Otherwise, no. But I think you're totally right. I was going to say
Integrated gradients.
SHAP,
Yeah,
line, all of
yes.
these. Okay, what are your thoughts on those? Because they don't have to do with model internals, right?
Well, in order to compute them, you need access to model internals.
Saliency maps, a
Right.
hill.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of the applications of these, they're not just word, input to output salience. People will also do output to in-state salience or in-state to output salience like that. So
Yeah.
they'll do salience over parts of the computation graph, which I think are interesting, so which you would more direct
Okay.
directly a lens on model internals when you do that.
Yeah, I really like that. That's something I was thinking about.
So you think about it. Have you ever have you ever met Gabriel Sarpi? Yeah, he's not starting with us until January, but he's in the NDEP community. It might be worth a conversation with him because he thinks about standing that zone. Yeah.
This is a good time to say too. I have like a very strong language model bias here because I am a linguistics student. So like I think salience, Shap, all of these are very good formation models, for
example. Well that's the heritage. And so the funny thing about Gabriel is he's trying to make it a thing for language models too, right? He's been trying to popularize that.
It is kind of making a comeback to attribution patching, right? Like attribution patching is a saliency map.
Yeah, but you know, even just direct application, like integrated gradients, I think, you know, you could argue that that it's worth a look.
Definitely.
And he's been spending some time on that. I feel like it's a natural question and something that maybe is more something that interdisciplinary researchers will ask. It's like, they want to know when they ask why they often want the salience in that. The other method that I'd ask about is influence functions. Yeah, do influence functions live in any of these categories?
So there's a whole like separate section of training and influence that I'm just not covering at all, right? Like you can think of this as just literally a single forward pass. When people use these models, there's the whole training part that comes before that forward pass, and then there's the whole inference part that comes with, you know, multiple forward passes. And there's a lot of work to be done, like research-wise, on both of these. I think that in long term, I'd want to get to those as well. Influence functions live on the left, right? And I have lots of thoughts on sampling on the right, but and that's something that I've been thinking about, just kind of putting it.
Can I say something? So both saliency maps and influence functions, they are approximations of causal mediation, right? So, I mean, we just cannot do causal mediation on them because it just takes so much time. I mean, then we technically can just put them on causal mediation or approximation of it. Maybe.
That does give a nice pedagogical branch. Like, not every causal thing is achievable, so we approximate it.
So you guys should take a look at the material as it's released and give Amir your feedback.
Yes, please. Give feedback.
Thank you, Amir.
Yeah, thank you.